I've never seen it hit anybody quite as hard as it hit me, but I was transformed in a moment from a Marxist, skeptic, scientist. It was then, and I will say it still is now, it is pure 100% magic. It's magic. It's not a drug. It's an event. It's not something that you do, it's something which happens to you. And people come out of it saying, what happened? What happened?
If you have the courage to do the things that are necessary to do, and we know what they are. And of course the first thing to do is to tell society to fuck off because they don't know what's going on.
Today's episode of the Plants of People 2 podcast is brought to you by Tom DeLonge and the Academy to the Stars. After an emergency approval from the FDA and a series of maiming attempts with a new Micro Super Megatron teleportation portal, DeLonge and the team at To the Stars has actually had a test subject mostly rematerialize in the current time and dimension. Before their last breath they got out in the future, everything tastes like cardboard. Well, I guess we won't know what this means until the future rolls around, or they pay off the student loans of some more eager test victims, I mean, pilots. When asked if he had any messages for the listeners, he looked up into the sky and simply said, So if you're interested in getting yourself out there, and potentially not coming back, contact Academy to the Stars, care of Tom DeLonge. 667 All the Small Things Drive, Las Vegas, Nevada 88901. We sincerely hope we hear from you again.
Magic. It's magic.
Okay, so episode, I don't know, we're on episode 9? Plants Are People 2 podcast. I'm here today with Diego, also known as Closet Medicine on Instagram. We're going to be talking about autoflowers and some history behind it. As a home grower, why autoflowers might be a beneficial type of seed to purchase, especially if you're a first-time grower. He's got a lot of background, interest, breeding stuff. It should be a good intro episode to autoflowers. So I'm going to let Diego do a little intro of himself, and then we'll go from there. How you doing, Diego?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. My Instagram is Closet Medicine, and the last 4 or 5 years now, I've really delved into cannabis, and it's opened my eyes to a lot of different things, including a lot of other plants as well. I grow a little bit of both. I mean, let's get right into cannabis. Autoflower and cannabis is a specific type of variety, versus the normal type of cannabis that everyone might be used to, where the normal cannabis is photodependent, which means it requires 12 hours of darkness in order to produce flowers. Autoflowers, however, are a little bit different, where they can flower under any light cycle. So you can have it on 24 hours of light, and it will flower when it's ready. They're very unique, and it was a very unique thing found in 1924 by a Russian botanist, which is interesting because if you look at where these have developed, it was actually a trait in the wild that was developed because of the photodependency of normal cannabis. These plants were getting much more hours of light during the day where they weren't able to flower. So during evolution and their genetic traits, they have developed to autoflower without the need for 12 hours of darkness. Just starting there. It's very interesting, and they'd like to call it another species of cannabis, and I'm not really sure about that, but it's definitely unique.
Yeah, I think generally it's considered a like a variety, right? Or a subspecies of that. But so you're the autoflower. I tend to think of Alaska when I think of autoflowers, and I'm trying to explain it to somebody. And you know, in the summertime in Alaska, they get, you know, full days of light, so they wouldn't be able to actually flower photoperiod cannabis, because their light would always be increasing, really.
Yes, exactly, and that's sort of that's actually, Alaska has found some ruderalis there. The name ruderalis is another subspecies of cannabis, comparable to indica and sativa, which are already
misnomer. Just explain it briefly for people. Why?
Well, as indica, it originates from India, and it has these qualities that they call it indicouch. That's how I remember. More equatorial. They're gonna want, they have much more energetic type of highs and buzzes. And this is a funny thing that I'm getting into now, where sativas, if you think about all the previous generation, I mean, the older folks that tried weed back in the day, and it was this brick weed from Mexico or Colombia, and there was these extreme sativas grown in these fields, it might have triggered some type of anxiety effect on them, potentially, and they've given up cannabis for good. And I don't think that's fair. I think that people need to give other types of, every plant has different effects, which is wild.
Yes.
So when you get into ruderalis, they want to call this other species, and it, because of these traits, but it's able to be crossed with the photodependent cannabis. And it's a recessive trait. The autoflowering trait is recessive, where you can cross autoflowers with photodependent, photoperiod cannabis that everyone knows, and the first generation of offspring will be photoperiod only.
Yeah, so that's really interesting that, you know, cannabis, it's really difficult, if not impossible, if it even exists, a real wild type cannabis plant, because of the human interaction over tens of thousands of years. And so, you know, thinking about that, they really think that like indica and sativa are both the same species, and that they were just moved, right, by humans along the way somehow.
Right. I mean, the plants were selected and passed down through humans. And if you're going deeper into indica and sativa for a minute before we get into more ruderalis stuff, the indica is found in, you know, mountain climates or cooler climates. It's made to finish fast to avoid the weather. And these people are smoking it because they're working hard in cold weather, and they needed something to help them relax. Whereas sativa, in an equatorial area, it's much hotter. They take a lot longer to flower, which means that they have a potential to develop different terpenes and cannabinoids that take much more time to develop, versus something like an indica, where you're talking a difference of 8 weeks of flower indica to a 16-week flower sativa. You may get some interesting things in there. So these people smoking sativas and harvesting these sativas, it's what worked in their area, but it's also something that they were smoking in order to work harder during the day in the crazy temperatures.
Yeah, I wonder if that ruderalis was, you know, it's, you know, the true... If there was a wild one, it had very little THC in it.
Well, right. Yes, that's definitely a good introduction to autoflowers at the beginning of their runs. They're ditch weed, to put it lightly. They don't have the potency, they're spindly type of cannabis bud structure. But over time, as you're introducing more photoperiod, photodependent plants and their traits into these autoflowers and working them, you can, they've greatly improved. Like nowadays, you know, there's 23% autoflowers, where back in the early 2000s, everyone was working with a particular type of ruderalis that was worked. It's believed to be worked over 9 generations in order to true breed for the autoflower recessive trait. And that's called lowrider. And when that came out, people were really not interested in those types of plants. It's a very short plant with a name like lowrider. They're very dwarf plants. And it took a while to get from that point in the early 2000s to where we are now, where there's a lot of things going on and a lot of different autoflower expressions, where it's not that bare bones ruderalis anymore.
Yeah, they've been able to cross it into some bigger budded plants and higher THC potency.
Exactly. And that what you said about Alaska, and I've seen the videos where the sun never sets, you can watch these time lapses, and that's exactly what it is. The environment made this happen, and we're taking these recessive traits and trying to add these qualities to them in the breeding process. But ruderalis has been found in a lot of different places, and it's typically very, very northern parts, Central and East Europe, and also Russia, a lot of Russian stuff. But it's also been found in North America, in Alaska, and Canada.
So the seeds that you can buy today as autoflower plants, I guess we were, before we started recording, we were talking about how you and I met. And I don't remember, somehow you sent me a seed list of, like, I think I was looking for, what is it, key lime, or lime pop kush was the seed.
Oh, right.
Honing in on at that time, I really wanted to try growing those. And somehow, I don't know if you had put up a post or something, or somehow I reached out to you, and you sent me your entire, like, seed catalog, and I was like, oh, this is, he's serious about all this stuff. And then, so I was actually growing autoflowers at the time, and that was one of the only times I've actually grown autoflowers. I grew them under a neon, like, shop light, and just left them on. I was just interested in the fact that they didn't have a photo period, and that I could just leave the light on the same light cycle the whole time. And
right, that photo dependency.
Yeah, and it was really, like, really simple. I didn't have to, like, repot them at all. It was like one pot and you're done. Because supposedly they don't like having the roots messed with or something, or you, like, delay that, the amount of days they're actually going to flower for.
Yeah, that's funny that you bring that up, and I just want to pause there just to make a note of that. Yeah. Autoflowers are extremely unique, where you want to plant in the final container a lot of the time. Nowadays, they're developing autoflower strains that are used to being transplanted, but typically they're easily stunted, so it puts people off of autoflowers because need to pay special attention to them in the first 30 days for them to get through their veg cycle and be able to shine at the size that they are.
So what is
very, very interesting.
What does that look like as a grower, those first 30 days planting your autoflower seed?
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't really know these types of things too, because autoflowers are still new, even though they've been around for, you know, since the lowrider stuff in the early 2000s, and they've improved over the last 10, 15 years. The autoflowers, when you're germinating seeds, they're going to sprout and they're going to set their tap root like any plant. But the difference between the autoflowering varieties and the photodependent varieties is that the autoflower is actually setting its root and its tap root to see how much room it has to grow. And you always hear more roots, more fruits.
Yeah, yeah.
The pot size definitely, the container size definitely, you know, establishes what the plant wants to do once it knows that size. And I've seen guys that planted autoflowers in 27-gallon totes of super soil, and they start out really slow. And what's going on that a lot of people don't realize is that they're setting their roots to understand how big they can grow and how big they can establish themselves. So if you're growing in a 1/2 gallon versus a 5 gallon, the 1/2 gallon is going to set its roots, it's going to do its thing, and it's going to be harvestable much quicker. The 5 gallon is going to take its time, it's going to veg for a lot longer, and then it's going to start flowering. Under this, it depends, because if you stress the plants, they can just flip like that. So that's why it's very important at the beginning to make sure that they're happy in order to not stunt them and make them think that I'm gonna die, I need to make sure that I produce, you know, these flowers and try to propagate.
Yeah. And that's, so what about, you know, another way you stress a plant is through topping. So in a photo period setting, you know, I'm always topping, you know, like if I'm growing outside 2 or 3 times before they start flowering. So for autoflowers, topping is a no?
Well, it's, I like to say it's strain dependent, because certain ones, I mean, you can go through the whole process of breeding and selecting for plants that would rather be topped and producing much more than something that if you top it, it's going to be sensitive to that and it's going to be stunted and you're setting it back. So initially, I would say don't top the autos unless you know what the strain is and if it can handle that. And certain autoflowers that I've bred myself, I've watched people top them and get great results. So it really depends on the plant.
Oh, I mean, it sounds like, you know, autoflowers are, it's, they sound a little complicated, but I think we need to, autoflowers are like, I feel like they're much easier once you understand the background of how they work and sort of like what the downfalls could be. Autoflowers for the first time grower, would you say that that's, they're easier or harder to grow than photo period plants?
Well, that's a little bit of a touchy subject, and I think I'm still on the fence about it. There's a lot of variables that go into that question. I started with autoflowers because people said autoflowers would be great for new growers, and I was paying a lot of attention to my plants, and they weren't the best plants because I was a very new grower. But if I were to have a person that doesn't know anything about plants, I would not suggest autoflowers to them. Photodependent plants are much more forgiving, where you can top them and you can take clones even. Autoflowers, you can't clone them. You can take cuttings and you can root the cuttings, but they have this internal clock that makes them flower no matter what, and they won't re-veg. Just want to make sure that everyone knows what re-vegging means. A photoperiod plant, when you're flowering it, you can flower its entire cycle and cut 90% of the plant off, 95% of the plant off, and you would actually put it under 18 to 24 hours of light and keep watering it, and it will actually revegetate itself. The remainder of the lower buds will turn into vegetative growth, and you can actually save those plants as keepers. But with autoflowers, you cannot do that.
And that, I mean, it takes months in some cases to actually get that plant to reveg, right?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. This is something that I like to tell people. It's a sort of a rule of thumb, and I'm not really sure where I learned this, but it's just something that has been tossed around. When you cut, let's say you had a week four flower plant, and you took a cutting and you rooted it, the amount of time that it takes to root that plant, plus the amount of time that it was in flower cycle, 12 hours of darkness, that's about the amount of time that it's going to start showing re-veg process. So if it's 2 weeks into flower, it'll be the amount of time to take to root, which is about 2 weeks, 10 to 14 days or whatnot, plus the amount of time in flower.
So I've seen people take their plants all the way to harvest all of it, realize that it's like they love it, and they want to save that plant, and then try to re-veg something that, you know, was in flower for 60, 70 days.
Right, that's exactly what it is. Autoflowers, the con of autoflowers, another con, is that you can't save any clones or cuttings. They just won't live. But like you said, if it was in 8 or 9 weeks of flower, the amount of time that it takes to root, or if it's just the stump of the plant, once you harvest and you put it back into a vegetation light cycle, it will take about 8 to 9 weeks in order to even make any type of new growth. But it works, you know?
Yeah, I guess if you already have a, you know, if there's already an existing root mass there, it's probably a little easier than trying to clone something that went into flower. Yeah, that's all really great information. What are you doing in terms of breeding right now? Are you breeding plants at this time?
It never stops. I mean, I'm always, you know, looking for the keepers, and there's a lot of different projects that I'm in the middle of. As far as autoflowers, I just started looking through some sativa dominant autoflowers, and I'm looking to make some F1 crosses from those.
Oh, so I really haven't seen you in a couple years, probably since, what, maybe 2019? And at that time I remember you had a seed separation machine you had made. And you were growing Anvil?
Oh, yes. Anvil from Gnome Automatics. He used to be called Mandalorian Genetics. His Instagram is fullduplex_AFN. And he has been a friend of mine for the past few years, and we've had a lot of back and forths and sharing genetics. And he's quite a big player now versus when, you know, back a few years ago, he wasn't as popular as he is now. So I'm very blessed to be able to be working with some of his gear.
Yeah.
And actually, this autoflower run that I'm doing, I'm looking through 9 of these regular autoflowers so they can be male or female, and it's his Damascus F3.
Let's just describe that for a second, the differences in seeds.
Right,
it applies across the board for photoperiod seed or autoflower seed, but
right, a lot of people get this part confused, especially newer growers coming into the scene, and I've had local friends that still can't tell the difference of things as much as I want to explain. But you have different different classes of things. So you have your ruderalis dominant autoflowers, and you have your photodependent photoperiod plants. And it's totally different classes. But then within those classes, the photoperiod or autoflower can be available in a feminized version or a regular version. Regular version just is normal male and females come out of those strains. So you can have autoflower males. But the feminized versions, it can be either way as well. Feminization is quite a different thing.
Yeah, as a brief overview, if you have a male and a female and you cross those genetics, in theory, 50% will be female of that progeny and 50% will be male. In a feminized version, you're artificially, like, hermaphroditizing that female into a male so you can get pollen, and those genetics are identical, so you're crossing them in, and it should be 90% females from the seed that you get?
I think actually it's about 1 in 500 is a male.
Oh, really?
And just to add some notes on that, the feminization process is something that is very unique. I mean, we as humans have, you know, XX as a female and XY chromosomes as a male. Same with these plants. I think they call it dioecious. What was it? Plants that have males and females.
On different plants.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So you can't, it's like the female plants require ethylene gas from the air. It's just naturally in the environment in order to produce their female parts. And with chemical reversing, you're actually inducing hermaphrodism in plants where the female has stomata, like a human has pores. It's how the plant respirates, it's how it breathes, and you're spraying these chemicals on it, which is typically colloidal silver or silver thiosulfate or even gibberellic acid 3. All these components, if you're spraying it on the plant that's trying to flower, it will actually block the sensors that are taking in the ethylene gas, and it will force the plant to produce male parts. A female plant. So now these male parts that are being made by a female plant, these are intersex traits and hermaphrodism. The pollen that it creates only contains the X chromosomes and no Y. So that's why when it's used to pollinate a female with female parts or even itself, you can actually reverse a specific part of the plant and pollinate itself with that pollen. Those seeds are basically all female. 1 out of 500 is a male.
So that's when somebody is buying feminized seed, the reason why you would buy feminized seed is that the genetics are very similar from seed to seed. So you can plant.
Well, not necessarily. I think there's a I don't want to get too complicated with things with our listeners, but there's a misrepresentation of feminized seeds and reversing onto the same plant, which is called an S1, a selfed one plant. So you could have Northern Lights number 5 reversed onto itself through chemical reversal, and that would be the Northern Lights number 5 S1. Those don't typically show the same traits as the mother. It's just how breeding works. It will show a lot of recessive traits because you're basically inbreeding with itself, and it will show certain mutations, and it will also show all the recessive traits coming from that mother. So the chances of you finding an identical plant from an S1 of a female is not really there. You're not really going to find anything identical to that mother.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's more close to the parent than the F1 an outbreeding would be with a male from a different plant.
Oh, definitely. I think it's a useful tool for preservation.
Yeah, trying to save something that, or move in a direction, right? See what those recessive traits are. Because those are always the interesting ones to me anyway.
Right, like we have something that's really unique in some of the guys that I do cultivation and breeding work with is Brothers and Farms Genetics. And we have a peanut butter breath S1 that my buddy Jat developed. And there's so many different things that are coming out of it that are always really good. So it's worth keeping certain things around.
Now, is that an autoflower or is that a photoperiod plant?
That's a photoperiod. So there's certain things with autoflowers versus photoperiod breeding that you can't do as well, which I wanted to mention. Back crossing with photoperiods is very easy.
So explain what back crossing is.
So back crossing, you're using a certain generation of a plant, of something that's bred to multiple generations of inbreeding, and then you're using that offspring to cross it with a previous generation of an original plant.
So break it down. So you have...
So if you have strain A crossed with strain B, and you grow out the offspring, that's the first generation of a unique cross of two different things. So now that you've grown those offspring, you could take a male from that offspring, the first generation, and hit it onto a cutting, a clone of the original mother. So it's like inbreeding in a weird way.
Yeah, that genetic pool is narrower.
Right, you're definitely bottlenecking certain things, but that can be beneficial whereas if you had a female that you really loved and you didn't want to go through the direction of feminizing that strain and crossing it with itself, you can take that strain and cross it with another male or something, take that offspring while you're keeping the original female, your favorite plant, around, and you're finding males in the offspring to continuously hit that original female. After, you know, back crossing two or three times, the offspring is going to be closer and closer to that original female that you loved.
Tell me about the peanut butter breath. Is that... What are you finding?
Peanut butter breath is awesome. It's it's really potent strain. I think it's tested over 30% in certain cases, and it was originally made by Thug Pug, which is a genetic company run by Nomarama, I think. Forget his Instagram.
What are you seeing come out of the seeds with your crosses? That's interesting.
I mean, this was worked by Brothers and Farms member, Jat, and he made the S1 and a bunch of outcrosses with that. And all I'm seeing is money. I mean, it's fire. There's a lot of things coming out of it, and everything is just very, very frosty.
Mm.
And that's what people are taken aback by. Like, a lot of people will be growing normal photoperiod plants, and that's what they know and love, and they experience an autoflower, and it may not be up to par to some of these exotic photoperiod varieties that have also taken a lot of time to develop.
Yeah. So the autoflower breeding realm is different because, you know, I was thinking about this in terms of capitalism, but, you know, like because you can't really clone those plants, you're constantly working in like a straight line forward. And in order to preserve those genetics, you've got to be breeding them. Right? Because if you had a pack of seeds that you grew out and you didn't breed them in any way, that sort of, all of that stuff is gone unless you got seeds from whoever grew them before.
That really hits home for me because I've really grown some awesome autoflowers and I've even attempted to pollinate them with other autoflowers where the pollen wasn't viable. And it really hurts. You can't keep things around. I couldn't re-veg it. I couldn't do anything with it. So I just have to enjoy it as a smoke.
Yeah, and so that's like, you know, I know that seed breeders, it seems like some of them have taken a long time to get into autoflowers. And there is always this like ongoing, I hear it, rumblings in like the cannabis community, but there's always, you know, people stealing this clone from someone else and calling it a different name and selling it and making money and I don't know, the whole cookies thing. And autoflowers seems like it's built to be like, it's almost like there's a level of protection in there in terms of like you know, that intellectual property, like it's an expiring thing. Like, you can give it to somebody, but they can't do anything beyond grow it, smoke it, and enjoy it. And then it's done. And then they have to come back to you to buy another pack. You know, unless they're savvy enough to be breeding on their own.
Right, that's an interesting thought, because a lot of the bigger names of autoflowers, like Mephisto Genetics and Night Owl Seed Company, and even Gnome Automatics is a little bit of a different realm, but those other two big ones, they've pretty much released almost exclusively femmes, so there's no way to find males in their work, except Night Owl released some regular versions of a few of his strains, and that was something that, you know, people used, and they made outcrosses with using males without having to use chemicals to reverse the plant. Whereas Gnome Automatics, also, you know, formerly known as Mandalorian Genetics, he always had regular versions of his strains available. Like you mentioned, the anvil, I used a male from the Anvil F6, and that was amazing, and has gone into a lot of other projects as well, in Brothers and Farms Genetics, their auto regular lines. Like, Brothers and Farms will release regular versions of their strains, and they weren't as common a few years ago.
Say that again, they're what?
Like, finding regular autoflower seeds was not common a few years ago. There weren't that many people releasing regular versions of strains, so it was harder to breed with autos, whereas Gnome Automatics had always released regular strains until recently. He's been doing his feminized stuff.
So do you think they were engineering it like that? They were intentionally only releasing feminized seed to prevent somebody from making their own autoflower seeds?
I think so. I think it makes it a lot harder, and obviously you can use chemicals to reverse any autoflower and make more seeds out of things, but it's much easier to have a regular version and look through the male expression and the female expression when you're talking the X and Y chromosome. It's just missing in the femmes.
So as a summary of what autoflower seeds are, they're
not photo period dependent. They're a little sensitive. You would not recommend them for a first-time grower.
Right, if this is a first-time cannabis grower, but they have a background like you, for instance, where you know a lot about plants and there's certain things to know about soil sciences and things like that, where if you're an experienced plant grower and it's your first time with cannabis, I would say try them. But if you don't know anything about plants or anything, I mean, photo periods are much more forgiving.
Yeah. That's a good little segue into, like, your grow setup and, you know, soil, maybe just a brief overview of, like, what your setup looks like, either indoors or outdoors. And... Okay.
Yeah, I do a lot of different sections. You know, I have a grow room inside and I have different size tents that are always constantly cycling through either, you know, a veg cycle or a flower cycle because I do work with photoperiods and autoflowers. And I'm actually working through autoflower cross with photoperiod strains to get them back to full expression of autoflowering. So that's a lot of what I've been targeting lately, is trying to get new photoperiod traits into new autoflowers to build, you know, hype and build actually more potency and things like that as well.
What have you been crossing quickly?
I've mentioned the Sativa Autoflower project I'm in the middle of, and anybody can reach out to me about that, but I've been working with these mutant cannabis, which is a whole another spectrum of a beast that could even be its own species, potentially, like autoflower, since it's a recessive trait.
Oh, you're what are they called again?
I've been leaning more towards the Australian bastard, but I have grown some of the Freak Show before. It's just that's a cross four strain when it was initially released, so it's already been heavily worked. Whereas Australian Bastard, I like to compare that to autoflowers a decade ago or more, where people weren't really interested in it. It's not, it doesn't have the best potency, it doesn't have the best, you know, cannabis, you know, flower structure. But as we continue to work it and as we continue to outcross it, I think there's huge potential in the lack of trim that needs to be done. The leaves are much smaller. If you look up Australian Bastard Cannabis, you'll be able to see some plants about that.
Yeah, so that sounds really interesting. That's like a... I wonder if that's a trait that... You know, I guess in some ways people are breeding for it unconsciously. You know, looking for something that's easier. Right.
I'd say let's have a whole nother episode about it, but let me just put something down real quick about it, just to finalize it, is that there was this, if you look it up, it's a cannabis infestation in Australia that was crazy huge. It was the size of like a lot of football fields, and they were trying to eradicate this cannabis for 9 years. And I believe that Australian Bastard was the result of them cutting cannabis-looking plants and not ones that didn't look like cannabis, so this was able to survive. And there's been a few different sources in Australia that this has been found, so I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's the Australian Bastard might be a result from this this cannabis infestation.
Thank you. So you're, how many, like, let's just walk through your process of, you know, soil for anyone who's interested in, you know, getting some grow tips.
Okay. I'll talk about my, outdoor. I do pure organics only. Indoor, I like to keep it simple with inert media and salt growing. Just to be honest, I don't really mind. It takes a lot of stress off of me because it's hard to do organics in smaller containers. That's true organic.
So
outdoor, I have a lot of different amendments. I built these maybe 12-inch raised beds, and every year I'm cycling in these just organic stuff. I mean, it's a whole list of dry amendments that I prepare in the early spring, and I mix everything in, and I also water in microbes. But it's basically, I use a lot of kelp meal is the biggest one. Alfalfa meal. I use some lobster meal. Some blood and bone meal. I'm not the biggest on that one, but I use green sand every year because it takes a lot of time to break down, as well as gypsum. I ran through a lot of different dry nutrients and mixing them and trying it with indoors and inoculating it with microbes and bacteria and fungi, mycorrhizae, but it's a lot easier to just run inert soil, inert media rather, indoors, whereas outdoors, I'm just trying to chock full all the nutrients I can and have it have enough time to break down in the plant available form.
Well, I see what you're saying. You're saying what media are your plants in indoors? Are they just in like are they on cubes, like Rockwool cubes, or they?
No. This is actually called Sunshine Mix Number 4 Advanced, which is 25% cocoa, 25% perlite. Oh no, 25% peat, and then 50% perlite.
Okay, so when you say you're growing with salts, that means you're using non-organic nutrients.
Right. For a while, I was using Greenleaf Nutrients Megacrop, and I think there's only, I'm not sure even what's in it. I haven't looked in all the ingredients, but they claim to be veganic. It worked for a long time, and it made growing indoor a lot easier.
Interesting. So you find that if you had like a pot inside in your tent, it's just too hard to keep that plant fed as much as you'd like to?
Well, as far as like organic growing, you want to be able to have a diverse soil. Yeah. And the larger the soil, the better. So when I'm growing in 3-inch pots or half gallons up to 2 or 3 gallons, I don't believe that that's enough to continue a living soil type of cycle that the plants can feed on. You need to be running certain beds. I've seen people run, you know, garden beds in a tent indoors where they're feeding, they've got extra worms in there, they're top dressing, they have different cover crops.
Yeah.
As far as clovers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's ways to do it indoor. It's just, I'm not in that situation. Like, I'd love to do that and I'd love to experiment with that. And I'm glad that I have outdoor in order to do full organic and see the results. But indoor, I have to keep it simple.
Now, do your outdoor plants do better than your indoor plants?
I would say no, because you can't control the environment like you can indoor. Outdoor, they get bigger and they have a lot more time in a veg process, where the flower cycle isn't going to start happening till early to mid August because of that light dependency of 12 hours of darkness happens about August. So you're kind of battling things through August and September and even early October or later with certain varieties that flower longer. You have a lot more battle of the elements versus indoor, where I can make sure that everything's in check.
This past summer, though, I think everybody like had a great outdoor season, because did you have outdoor plants that finished a lot earlier than you expected?
I actually know what you're talking about, because there was a guy that is local, and he had a bunch of plants outside, and they started flowering very, very early, too early.
Yeah.
And they actually went through a process because the light was greater than 12 hours. They went through a re-vegging process, and basically it started flowering, it started re-vegging, and then it started flowering again. So it was very weird, airy stuff. I mean, everyone was pissed off this year because there was a lot more rain versus last year.
Hmm. See, I feel like this summer, or this past summer, I thought it rained a lot. We had a lot more. It was rainy initially in the early part of the season. And then, so all of my plants were sort of delayed. And then, August into September, it seemed like they were way ahead of a normal summer. And then I was harvesting, 2 weeks earlier than I normally would have been. And, of course, I still had plants that I harvested at the normal time that I would have any other year, except this particular year. And it could have been genetics, too. Those plants maybe just, finished earlier, or, I don't know. It just seemed like maybe it was fire-related from the West Coast, or maybe it was because we had a lot of rain initially. I'm not sure what the, the variables are that went into that whole scenario of, but that was a common thing across the board for a lot of people. It was like, everyone was like, oh, my plants are done. And it's like, just the third week in September or something, or it was just really surprising. But that didn't.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I had plants that flowered later this year, and that was because of what I put outside. And it actually worked out because we got all that early rain, and they were still in veg, and they actually loved it the whole time in veg. Whereas I had other local people that sort of planted into gravel, kind of. It was like a weird spot, and they're like, oh, everything's flooding. There was no drainage there, and they're like, oh, well, my outdoor's ruined. Like, well, you should have thought about that a little bit,
They planted straight to gravel?
Yeah, it was this weird spot where imagine a dirt road, back dirt road, that's been plowed, and all the extra top rocks have been piled in this area and have been flattened out, and they dug these maybe 5-gallon bucket-sized holes and filled it with soil and called it a day. So once all the stuff backed up with all the water, everything was just the stems of the bases of the plants were in 2 inches of water because it had nowhere to go. Like, oh, well, that's a problem.
Yeah, totally. Have you been, it's so nice to, live in a place where you don't have to guerrilla grow anymore. You don't have to plant in gravel. You can actually, like you do, amend your garden every year and plant those things out back and let them get huge. Have you been paying attention at all to what's going on with the rec legalization in Vermont?
Yeah, that's a great question. Basically, the plan is that the recreational growing licenses are going to come out in the springtime, and the first projected recreational sales in Vermont will be in October. And there's a whole range of sizes of indoor and outdoor and these hybridized licenses they can purchase. I think that they've taken their time enough already. You don't want to rush them through the process, but they're taking information from bordering states that have already legalized, and they have their own processes. The licenses are going to require a lot more than people think, honestly. And it sucks to be a downer about it, but there's certain things that are going on where you're going to have to be a certain amount of miles away from a school, and you're going to have to tell your neighbors in a certain distance that this is going on. I don't know. I don't know how people are going to take it at first. I'm kind of watching the scene, and Eli Harrington is a big name in Vermont cannabis politics, and he always has a lot to say about it. And I've given him phone calls, his personal phone calls, and he's great to reach out to. I would actually suggest you do an episode with him, possibly.
Huh. Eli Harrington?
Yeah, Eli Harrington. He's up in the north, but he runs Vermontawana.
Okay.
He was actually one of the owners of Hetty Vermont, but there he backed out and he's selling his shares, I think, soon. It's going to be all women and cannabis type of thing. I think Hetty Vermont's changing towards women and cannabis, and they've been doing a lot of events in California and stuff.
Interesting. Well, that's good. We need more women in cannabis.
Yeah, Vermont's great. There's actually a part of the licensing where it's as a nursery where you seed sales or clone sales. I think that's more along my line because I don't grow cannabis to sell to people. I just like the plant. I like the genetics and I like the seeds. So
they're going to have, that's surprising that they're going to allow seed sales or something that isn't, you can walk into a dispensary and if you ask for seeds, they'll look at you like you're fucking crazy. But like that, to me, if I wanted seeds, like that's where I'd go to get seeds if I was I didn't know any other places to get them, but they don't have any sort of like, I went out to California and walked in there and I thought I was going to buy seeds and they were like, yeah, we don't sell seeds. And, you can get them online, but it's not like a common thing for a state to support seed sales. So have you heard that that's going to happen in Vermont?
Yeah, they had the projections of the costs of the licenses as a business storefront to sell seeds and clones. I think maybe it was $4,000 for the license.
That's incredibly cheap. Seems like
I agree. I mean, the amount of, stuff, loops you have to go through to have clean cannabis medicine. I mean, that's one thing that I smoked for a dozen years before I started growing. And nowadays, I'm mostly smoking my own homegrown cannabis that's not sprayed with chemicals. It's you don't know where things are coming from, and you don't know if there's mold or bugs in these things.
What do you think about testing?
I think testing is important. I'm not sure how I feel about potency testing. I think that that's something that needs to be worked on. I think there's a lot of fake test results out there. That's just how I feel. But I feel like, any type of testing or anything that's particles, like different sprays are very dangerous. And I heard stories of people starting to grow 20 years ago and they start to spray their plants because they have spider mites and they're spraying with this Eagle 20 or something. And that's made for tomatoes and it's totally fine for tomatoes. They get washed off and you can eat them, but they're not thinking about the factors of spraying something onto this flower that's going to be dried and then combusted, where now these chemicals that are involved with the spray actually turns into, some cyanide gas potentially, and you don't know who's using these sprays. Like, I smoked for that long and I didn't know where any of it came from or what it was called or anything like that. So it's nice to be able to have my own homegrown that I can watch and I can know what it's been through, and it makes it a lot better experience.
Yeah, I wonder what I read through like a draft proposal of the recreation, how they're going to roll it out, and the testing component in there says that the margin of error is 10%.
plus or minus. So that means if you...
How are you supposed to know when it's under the legal hemp limit, if it's 10% off?
Well, I mean, you know, it's exactly, I think 10% is a crazy, this is back to your point that, like, testing in terms of potency shouldn't be relevant, and it probably isn't relevant, especially if you're putting a 10% plus or minus margin of error on it, which is insane. You know, and there's a lot of different things with a plant. Like, if you send in the top bud, that one may have been producing more terpenes, more cannabinoids, and so that particular bud might test higher, and that might be what the grower wants, because that may sell better. But overall, the lower buds on that plant might be 3 to 5% less THC.
Right, exactly. And that's definitely a good point, where it definitely changes with the moisture content and things like that. Testing, it's not really reliable, I don't think, in my opinion. And I just want to bring this up, and I'm not going to name any names, but there's a local facility that tests, and there was a person that told me that they submitted 4 or 5 samples of the same plant under different names and got all different results.
Yeah. So it's
now they have this COA, certificate of authentication, on these 5 different, supposedly different strains. It's just kind of like, what's the point, you know?
Why would somebody want to do that? Have 5 different, were they just like testing the system to see what would happen?
Right, that's what it was. They were seeing what the results would be if it was the same top nugs from the same plant, all very similar samples sent in with all crazy different numbers. Like you said, 10% off on some of these. One was 18% CBD and one was 28% CBD, and it was from the same plant.
Yeah, so that's what they're doing, is they're taking the test result with the highest amount of CBD and then using that to market, which is scary.
Yeah, testing is definitely odd, and the best way to test it is just to smoke it yourself, I guess. I mean, it's hard with CBD because it's not going to affect you in your mind. But if you have ailments and things, it could even act as a placebo in certain ways.
Yeah. I mean, I smoke.
If you're thinking anything's going to help you and you try anything you can, something might help you even if it's not really helping you.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I smoked weed for 20 years, and I had no idea what the percent of THC was in the weed. And it didn't really matter to me. And that's, I mean, I also don't care, like, I also didn't know if it was indica or sativa, quote unquote. And I would just, there was also very little choice. You would go to somebody's house, they would have a bunch of jars, or maybe one jar, and that was what you paid for. And, you know, that was your stash for the week. But now you can go into a dispensary and you can look at all the names and all the percentages, and, you know, I don't know offhand how they, you know, it would be interesting to look at sort of what percentages sell the most. And I would guess that it's probably the highest, and then something like under 20, like in the 16 to 18 percent range, and that's probably going to the old nostalgic people who want to smoke weed like from, you know, the 70s or 80s, something that's a little less potent.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I did work in a dispensary, medical dispensary in Vermont, and the most we saw was people coming in wanting the most potent, highest THC strains. And I just want to dive into how cannabinoids and terpenes interact with each other, because there are certain strains that have a high myrcene as a terpene content, which actually helps the body absorb the cannabinoids through the blood-brain barrier. So if you had something that was, you know, 15% THC with high myrcene content, it may hit you a lot harder than something that's, you know, 25 or 30%.
Interesting. So it acts as almost like a MAOI inhibitor or something?
Right, like the terpenes have an effect on what's going on as far as how the cannabinoids work. Where you know, they say, oh, you smoke weed and you get the munchies. It's not very accurate. That's like one particular kind of weed that will give you munchies, and that may account for most of the things that you've been able to try. But one of the varieties that I kept around for about 3 years is Super Lemon Haze crossed with Garlic Breath. And that one suppressed my appetite so hard. Like, if I smoked before I eat, it wouldn't make me hungry at all.
I guess I've smoked weed that has given me the munchies, but it's not a common thing for me to like want to eat food after I get high. Normally I just want to like do stuff. It's very like motivating.
Right, that's what I always want to look for, is that, you know, they want to call it sativa dominant things that make you more energetic or more creative or more motivated versus something that's just going to want to make you fall asleep. So the Super Lemon Haze is a haze being sativa that definitely brought out some wild properties. And my wife's father, he's like in his 70s, and he grew a clone I gave him a couple of years ago. And he still has, you know, some of the nugs around, and he's like, wow, there's something different about this one. It makes me, you know, want to go do all these things. He's got this crazy train set that he builds in the spare room.
I wanted to ask you about, so just briefly touching back on this, the Vermont recreational legalization type thing. In Vermont right now, we can cultivate our own cannabis as a home grow, but the limitations on that are 2 plants in flower and 4 plants in veg. I had heard that they were going to change that to be 1,000 square feet, which, you know, for me anyway, my problem, I'm really interested in genetics and like looking through a lot of things. And, you know, with a two plant limit, really, that's really hard to do, because you know, as if somebody was going to start growing, you know, this with recreational legalization, and there's this little like boom in people being interested in growing cannabis. But like, for somebody to really be successful doing that, you know, unless they spend $300 or $400 on like really quality seeds, or they luck out and have a bag seed that turns out to be awesome, the only way you can really find those really special plants is to plant a lot of seeds. And, you know, at least with moving from that 2 or 6 plant limit, depending how you look at it, the 1,000 square foot option, for me at least, is going to allow me to do a lot more in a shorter amount of time. Do you think that, like, what's your, you know, and I guess you don't have to say if you don't want to, but like, what's your pool look like in terms of like how many plants are you getting to look at and really see what the potential is in that particular batch of genetics?
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting question. And with working with some of the mutant genetics and recessive traits coming along, I definitely need to pop a lot of seeds in order to get projects done.
And so have you heard anything about that 1,000 square foot increase?
I haven't heard that, but that honestly is kind of getting me excited if they move in that direction. And I don't think that plant count really makes sense. And you can tell that some of these politicians aren't necessarily familiar. They're not familiar with the plant enough to know that, you know, some other states do certain height requirements in their home grows. Like you can only have certain amount of plants under certain height limit, which just really doesn't make sense. And I always like to say, with Vermont's plant count in 2 flower and 4 veg, you can easily have a plant that spans the width of 10 feet by 10 feet.
Yeah, a single plant.
That's just one plant. So now you have all these other plants. Like you could have a warehouse filled with 2 plants, 6 plants.
Yeah. I don't. You know, it's like you have to break the law at some point, though, because, you know, if you're planting regular seed, if I was going to plant six seeds, that's my legal limit. Statistically, three of those seeds are going to be male, and I don't want them anyway. And so now I have 3 plants again, and I have to wait long enough for those plants to actually show sex before I even know that 3 of them were male. So there's like, I agree with you that the legislative body that sort of determines this stuff, and I know there's subcommittees and all these other things that have farmers and people who are connected to the cannabis community involved in them, and that's partially why we see some of the changes that we've seen in the sort of what's written up in terms of what the policy and law will be in the future. But a lot of it is confused and doesn't really make sense. And it would be so much better if Vermont was just like, you know what? We don't give a shit. Just grow whatever you want. Like if somebody really grew 1,000 plants a 1,000 THC plants out in their meadow or whatever, if they were really going to cultivate those and harvest them and dry them and cure them, and then, like, I don't know what the law would think they were going to do, put it on the black market or something. Even if they had to do that, they would have to hire so many people to take care of those plants. And really, I think Vermont is missing out on a huge economic opportunity, because if they were to say you can grow as many plants as you want, we're doing away with a plant limit, I think you would have lots of people and cannabis growers who are interested in looking at genetics flock here to be able to grow as many plants as they wanted to actually find new interesting terpenes or, you know, new versions of plants that are better than the old ones, and really target craft cannabis cultivation in Vermont as a state. And I think we're missing that right now. I think we're making a huge mistake by continuing to limit what people can grow.
Well, the thing about Vermont is that people have always done it and they're always going to continue to do it. And that's something that these people are thinking about, trying to make the most profit, you know, and taxing everything that's sold, which makes sense. And that's going to come with a lot of testing, a lot of making sure that these products are safe as well. And some of even the medical dispensaries in Vermont are owned by, you know, out of the country companies, and they've had a lot of issues with mold and stuff like that, and they're not doing proper testing even in the medical scene.
What do you think about that right now? They're gonna, so if they, Vermont's gonna have a rec market, licenses are gonna go be available in July, right? So that's with the expectation that people are going to grow outdoors, right? And then be able to sell that cannabis that they grew outdoors to a dispensary in Vermont and not have mold issues?
I mean, there's going to be a lot of issues that come up and a lot of people that invest in it thinking that it's going to be easy money, and it's really not. I mean, there's so many stories where I think Vermont should be looking at states that have been doing it for the longest, like Oregon and Washington and California, where the market gets saturated, you know, extremely quick. I think Vermont is trying to do it the smart way as far as getting smaller growers the opportunity to be able to afford licensing for yep. smaller grows, indoor and outdoor and hybrid licenses, and having these, you know, proposals of prices. I think they're heading in the right direction. I think that they're way behind if you look at bordering states like New York and Massachusetts, and even New Hampshire is coming online with home grow soon. It's like we're surrounded, even Canada, I mean, we're surrounded by crazy markets that Vermont as a brand name, like anything labeled as Vermont, as a non-native Vermonter, I think that's a huge selling point as far as cheese and maple syrup and cannabis. I think cannabis is the next thing. Apple cider and stuff here is huge, where I think cannabis, like people in California are going to be wanting to try these outdoor Vermont cannabis, you know, products. And CBD products have been coming up in the last couple years, few years with Vermont. It's like, we need to make it more accessible, and they're trying to make that happen. But I still think that if you look at the medical market and the medical licenses that are held, it's big companies in Canada and these weird companies that are starting to own a lot of these enterprises. And that's what I'm hoping that Vermont's able to avoid moving forward.
Yeah, that will be good. You're talking about like Mad Men and stuff.
Yeah, like Curaleaf, and then there's another Canadian company that just bought out the Southern Vermont Wellness and Champlain Valley Dispensaries Group.
Oh, really? It seems like that's a common thing going on in Vermont right now. Like, people with a lot of money coming here and buying up a lot of property and, like, business storefronts. I think Brattleboro just had that happen with somebody was in there buying up a bunch of storefronts and then raising the rent on everybody.
It's I think I saw that it was they like named the specific guy who's just like from wherever he's from, and it's like, well, if the state would help these businesses continue forward, it's like sort of like gentrification or something, whereas this area is already expensive as it is.
Wicked expensive. For what it is, it shouldn't be rent downtown. Shouldn't be, you know, $1,300 or $1,400 a month. It's insane. I don't even think there might not even be a rental market right now because there's nothing to rent.
Yeah, exactly. I've been experiencing that too with my family members in the area and good friends in the area. It's like it's very weird to want to stay here, and it's like, oh, I don't want to see these people move away, but now they're kind of getting forced to, and there's much cheaper options that, you know, you can live a better standard of living.
Yeah, somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
Let's, what else are you growing other than cannabis? What else are you interested in? You still doing peppers?
Yeah, I was. I just started an indoor pepper project that I'm gonna keep indoor. I have this ornamental variegated pepper that has the leaves. It has this white and purple and green foliage that kind of is interchanging, and I germinated a bunch of those, and I've got some variegation going on, and there's two other varieties I also planted that were very dark black leaf pepper varieties. One is the Count Dracula pepper, and the other one is called Black Pearl.
What does the fruit look like?
The black pearls are upward facing, round, you know, black pearl looking pods. The Count Dracula hang, and they're longer, actually. They're like two inches or so, 1 to 2 inches longer peppers, but they start out very black like the foliage, but they turn into this red color, which is like bloody fangs. That's why they called it the black, the Count Dracula.
And are they super hot?
They're varying. I would like to say that they're all under 100 Scovilles.
And so for Scoville is the unit of measurement of heat for a hot pepper.
Yeah. The Scoville units, I actually meant to say under 100,000 Scovilles. But for reference, it's jalapenos are between 3,000 and 9,000.
Okay.
And one of my favorite peppers that I grow every year, and I make these dried pepper flakes, sort of like at a pizza place, except yeah. They're 470,000 Scovilles.
Oh my god! How do you measure that? How does the Scoville get measured?
They break it down in a laboratory based on the oils of the pepper. There's actually a really cool documentary. I believe it's actually Vice.com or something. That's the guy that made Carolina Reapers, and it walks through his whole pepper greenhouse. And he actually works is like one of his best friends is like breaks down all the pepper Scoville units in his laboratory.
I'll have to look that up. How are you getting your, are you sending your peppers out to get tested?
No, I just have to assume based on the lineage, the breakdown of its genetics, and gotcha. Basically testing it with my tongue as well.
Yeah. You growing anything else other than peppers?
Actually, I was just about... I have a lot of houseplants, and that's why I was hoping you'd be around today. But we'll have to plan to meet soon, and I would love to have you check out my houseplants. But as far as my cannabis grow room, I do have some peppers going that I explained, but there were certain seeds that I got through a trade. Actually, they were gifted to me from one of my traders that I've compiled this trading group on Discord, and he sent me some giant sequoia tree seeds.
Yeah.
And those ones I was going to try to germinate soon, and he sent me a bunch of other types of seeds. One was a dragon tree.
Hmm. The sequoia, I've tried to grow those before, I think. I think they have a stratification period. You have to like give them some cold and wet for a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. There are certain plants that do require that, and I just want to touch on the subject real quick as a seed preservationist and having a large collection of cannabis seeds. It's very important to store them in the right way. There are some seeds that have been around since the 70s and the 80s, and they're still able to be germinated as long as they're stored properly. And some people think that, you know, well, it's not them thinking, it's just storing cannabis seeds in the refrigerator or the freezer can definitely elongate their lifespan as far as their germination rates. But it can be a dangerous game when you're a collector and you're preserving strains, or you're actively trading certain things because of that cannabis is not always something that needs cold stratification.
Right.
But there are certain variety of seeds that I have that were sent to me by a friend in Alaska, and him and his brother go out to certain places in Russia and Siberia and Kazakhstan and Bashkortostan, and he's collected these feral ruderalis seeds, these wild autoflowers. And he actually has all the latitude and longitude marked down on all the seed packages. His name is Guardian of the Lost Terps on Instagram. And he's a really cool guy, and I have a lot of his genetics that he's sourced from the wild. Now something I wanted to be able to gift you if you were here.
Oh, right on. Yeah. No, that sounds amazing. He's just traveling and finding this stuff out in the woods?
Yeah, like in the wilds of Siberia and Russia. I mean, there's the Siberian ruderalis. All the latitude and longitude is written down, so you'll be able to, you know, find it on a map where exactly they harvested the seeds. And that's super interesting to me. There's the one that's from Kurgan, Russia, and the Bashkortostan one is cool. And just going back to autoflowers and where they originated from and how all these newer autoflower hybrids with photoperiods have developed from this lowrider and lowrider 2 autoflowers that were true breeding. Well, now we have access to these much bigger autoflowers. Like the lowrider was known as much more dwarf plant, where these Siberian autoflowers can grow to 5-6 feet tall. It just depends. And that's another thing that I said, was how the autoflower taproots are kind of feeling out where they can grow and how much they can grow. It's imagining these plants in the wild that are on the side of the road or in these weird rocky areas in Siberia with extreme cold and not any darkness. They just develop this, which is very special.
Yeah, that sounds... I'm going to have to follow him. That sounds amazing. So does he think that those are actually, like, true wild species of ruderalis?
Yeah, these are just in the wild, and they're flowering, and they're not under, you know, the photodependent light cycle, so they're flowering on their own, and anything harvested from that is just how nature selected it in that area.
Super cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential because it's like ditch weed and it's made to survive. And they call cannabis weed for a reason. I've always heard that from some of the older growers, especially in Vermont. They're like, don't explain all this scientific thing about pH or, you know, vapor pressure deficit to me, because this is just a weed and it will grow how it wants to grow. And I'm trying to improve, you know, their knowledge and improve their plants and their yields. And it took a while for some of the guys, like they're 60 something years old. And it's like, it took me 2 or 3 years to, you know, get in their heads. And now they're growing really quality stuff, you know?
Yeah. I think, you know, that's something that I sort of learned when I was able to grow outside, was that, you know, if you put your plants in the ground as opposed to a pot or even one of those fabric pots, they're pretty low maintenance. You can just, you know, amend your soil, dig a pretty big hole, you know, so it's loose soil around it, put that plant in it, and once it gets established, like, I barely even water my plants, you know, other than when I feed them. And they just do their own thing, pull in their own, you know, moisture from the soil, and they get rained on when it rains, and when it doesn't rain, they get sunned. And it's like, you know, they have a pretty... it's a lot less work than growing inside or trying to do the whole, like, potted cannabis plant on your porch thing. It just made a whole lot easier for me in terms of, like, because I'm not always around in the summertime, so, like, having those plants just be sort of self-sufficient was a big, big move in the right direction.
Yeah, that's how I treat my outdoor photo period plants and even autoflowers. As long as I have an established bed that has a diverse, microbiology in there and fungi capacity, all I do is at the beginning, before I even plant the plants, I'm using the dry fertilizers and mixing them in, and I'm watering in with microbes and fungi in order to break that down enough time where once I put the plants in, there's a lot of available nutrients. And throughout that whole cycle, in the beginning, it's just watering in microbes. I'm trying to introduce, the diversity there to break everything down. And then it's all plain water through the heat of the summer. I'm just plain water, make sure everything's moist every day, and they grow like crazy. It grows like a weed. I mean, it grows super thick, and the roots reach 5-6 feet away into my garden bed to mess up my other plants' nutrients. And it is what it is. But there's a little trick that I do outdoor, and it happens in the middle of July. I will top dress around the base of my plants with, I use Costa Maine brand fishbone meal. And I just layer that on, the fishbone meal, right in the middle of July, and I water in very good. And that will break down over the next 30 days. By the time the middle of August comes in and they're starting to flower, they'll be able to have all this extra flower boosting nutrients from the fishbone meal.
Yeah. Yeah, Costa Maine has some pretty good products. And they're pretty ubiquitous. They're everywhere.
Well, where we are.
Yeah, well, where we are. Yeah, that's true.
It's just fun to see California soil bags here with Fox Farm and all that stuff. It's like kind of a little bit weird to think how far it traveled and where it was made. And I'd rather just source local ingredients.
Yeah. Yeah, or, make your own soil. But for people, sometimes it's a lot easier for them just to, instead of having to learn about N, P, and K and ratios and where all these things come from and how to mix them together. And, I feel like there's always this initial sort of like hemming and hawing over cannabis plants. And even though it's called, it's weed and it grows everywhere and it grows pretty easily, people get very, nervous about, not doing it right. Just people who I give seeds out pretty much every spring to a bunch of different people. And for, 2 or 3 months, I get text messages, every week or so about they're showing me the plant and is this okay? And I'm just like, yeah, just let it do its thing. Like, stop worrying about it. And that's, in my own experience over the course of my growing period, I really don't give a shit anymore. I just I pick out some plants that I want to grow out of my seed bank and plant them out there. And then I just watch them and just see what they do. They have pretty much the same soil type and they're all outside and they just sort of do their own thing. And that's really how I should be doing it, because I'm not going to really take care of them, in a hypersensitive way like I would if I was growing them inside somewhere, because they are sort of on their own. And if one doesn't make it or one's really moldy, I have backup plants. Hopefully I have enough that I can just grow my own stash for the year that I'm going to, smoke that weed in. But some plants will just get really moldy and you just scratch them. They're just done. That wasn't one that was going to be, smokable anyway. And the genetics were probably poor and it wasn't mold resistant. So, cut it down and try again next time or try something different.
We are getting to almost 2 hours. Should we put a little bow on this?
Yeah, yeah. Let's cap it off. And if you have any more questions, I've got plenty to explain.
Yeah. What? How should we cap it off?
Let me think. I think overall, autoflowers are very unique. They're an amazing type of plant, and I think it could be for anybody as long as you're familiar with plants and you're familiar with growing plants. They have a great history, and it's great to look into, and it's one of those things where people really looked down on it 10 or 15 years ago, and now that it's actually being competitive with the regular photodependent plants, I think it's something to look out for. And I want to mention, there was a book, I think it was by Ed Rosenthal, and he made an autoflower book that was for beginners that anybody's grandma could read and be able to understand how to take care of the plant.
Is that a new book by Ed?
Yeah, it came out at the beginning of 2021.
Okay.
And it was, I think it's going to be a good book. I still have yet to read it, but it's going to be very basic. I think people need to have it broken down a little bit more. And one sure. thing I want to mention, if there are Vermonters listening, I have a lot of seeds. I'll give you free seeds. I'll ship them to you. Just to grow, just to try it, just to experiment. I mean, it's legal enough for you to grow outside or inside or whatever you want to do. And I'm open to give advice to a certain extent. Like, I'll get you started. And I think I've been doing it for the last 2 or 3 years, giving free seeds to Vermonters, because I want to elevate the state and I want to make sure that we're moving towards the end of prohibition. And certain people that aren't for it, or they had a bad experience and they think it's a bad thing, there's a lot of different types of plants out there that can have a lot of different effects. That's what I gotta say.
Totally. That's a good message, man. That's really nice of you to offer to send seeds to anybody.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a bit now, and it's like, there was a lady in Burlington that had cancer, and she, you know, asked me for some seeds. I mean, I'd love to send any Vermonter without any disabilities, just grow what you can, you know. Everybody needs to experience it. And after about a dozen years of smoking and seeing my first live plant, it was a life-changing experience, fully flowering, smelling beautiful plant.
Yeah, that is true. It is quite the sight to have some really big nuggets growing on some plants out in your backyard.
Yeah, and keeping it simple, like, I need to put out like a guide or something. I need like a simplified guide and get people in Vermont more interested in being able to grow in their closets. Like, closet medicine, as my name, I started in the closet, and I had the small space, and it's just become a passion of mine that anybody can do it in that small space under a certain budget and be able to not have to buy random cannabis from the street that you don't know what is sprayed with some chemical cancer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, thank you so much, man, for sharing everything you know with us and having a conversation here today. So one more time, they can reach you on Instagram at Closet Medicine.
Yep. Yep, at Closet Medicine on Instagram, and you can visit biffbeans.com, biffbeans.com. That's a brotherhood of a lot of breeders that I'm involved with, and we'd love to see more people running the genetics. So we have people all over the world, and we have a community that's based around testing the genetics before it's released. So I'd love to just shout those guys out. I've been working with them for about 3 years, and we have a lot of stuff coming up, so